Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next half hour, we're going to update and introduce a number of different stories, in some cases introducing the stories, and in some cases updating stories from previous broadcasts. If the supplemental and interpolative discussion seems somewhat abbreviated for the purposes of some listeners, I can appreciate that. Due to the limitations of time, that will necessarily be the case. I will refer interested listeners to Spitfire. That's a tape duplication service that stocks the various tapes that I've done for other tapes that will flush out your understanding. So without further ado, let's get right to the subject material. We're going to begin with an article from the Financial Times of London's weekend edition of March 20th and March 21st, of 1999. This concerns a major story which took place this past week, namely the resignation en masse of the European Commission. Now, this is the single most important, or was the single most important governing body of the European Union, and this consequently hands much more power to the European Parliament, which had previously been secondary in importance. The significance of this is severalfold. First of all, the European Parliament has a disproportionate number of arch-right-wingers and outright fascists and Nazis in its ranks. The significance of this had been overlooked because the European Parliament didn't have that much power. Now it has a lot more power, and hence the ultra-right-wing representation in that body, which is disproportionate, is much more significant. Also, the op-ed column that I'm about to read ventures the thought that the resignation of the European Commission will reduce the influence of both France and Germany, France and England, excuse me, in the European Union. The rotating presidency of the European Union is currently in the hands of the Germans, and despite the pronouncements by the alleged center-left government in Germany that they now are consider themselves Europeans and not Germans and so on and so forth, in many critical respects, at least with regard to international affairs, this has been the most chauvinist and reactionary government in post-World War II German history. And in particular, they have been attempting to wrest economic concessions that had been made in the agricultural field to France, and through EU rebates to the United Kingdom. This, by the way, is discussed in an update on various stories that was recorded earlier this year. This op-ed column, again, from the Financial Times of March 20th and March 21st of 1999. This is an op-ed column by Quentin Peel, P-E-E-L, entitled Earthquake in Europe, subtitled Not Many Dead, But the EU's institutions will never be the same again, and this will prove a big challenge for the two most nationalist EU members, France and Britain. I would say take the notion that those are the two most nationalist members with a grain of salt. However, the shift in power is going to reduce their influence in the European Union, and that, I think, is very significant, and in the long run will benefit German hegemony. This column reads in part, "The resignation of Jacques Santé and his 19 fellow European commissioners was not just a localized disturbance caused by a few minor cases of cronyism and mismanagement. Nor is it likely to prove a small tremor with dramatic short-term effects but no lasting damage. Rather, it has permanently changed the constitutional landscape of the European Union, marking a radical shift in power from the non-elected bureaucracy, the Commission, to the elected European Parliament. The question is whether the damage it has done by tarring all the institutions of the EU with the same brush of corruption and incompetence, and severely denting the morale of Europe's bureaucracy, will outweigh the positive long-term benefit of greater democratic control." Skipping down. "But regardless of whether they think the upshot will be good or bad, almost everyone agrees on what happened. Power has begun to shift towards the European Parliament, the nearest thing to a genuinely pan-European institution, and away from the other pillars where national influences still hold sway, the Council of Ministers, in which the 15 member states negotiate common decisions and legislation, and the Commission, which is the EU executive and civil service all at once." And again, note that there is a disproportionate number of Nazis and fascists and far-right members of the European Parliament, that had previously been overlooked by many observers because that body did not have that much power. Its power has now increased, and this figures to reduce the influence, as I said, of France and England, this at the time when Germany is attempting to reduce its economic commitment to the EU, and specifically to cut monies going through the agricultural sector to France and through EU rebates to the United Kingdom. On those subjects, we read, skipping down, If the Parliament emerges from the present upheaval as a serious player on the European stage, two member states above all others are likely to be concerned, Britain and France. For both are the most effective exploiters of the national interests in the EU, although Spain has now joined the band, and both are the most congenitally suspicious of the European Parliament and have consistently resisted any big extensions of its powers. For France in particular, the past week has been devastating. For the past 40 years, Paris has been a consummate player of Brussels' power politics, thanks to brilliant exploitation of the bureaucracy and shrewd use of personnel placement. Certain areas like agriculture have become virtually a French national fief, dominated by top French civil servants. And due to the pressures to keep the EU functioning, this observer, Quentin Peel, believes that it's very likely that the concessions that Germany had been seeking will be arrived at with regard to the negotiations on Agenda 2000, namely the EU's agenda for the future. Under that rubric, Germany has been pushing for the concessions that I mentioned. Quote, "They have got to show they are decisive, otherwise they will be letting the MEPs make all the running," unquote, a French official concluded, again quoting, "I think the chances of a deal next week are now vastly improved." And it remains to be determined to what extent the exposure of the corruption of the European Commission and its resulting resignation may have been a German gambit. Again, the Germans, with their currently holding the rotating presidency of the EU, have been behaving in a very idiosyncratic and nationalist fashion. Two articles appeared in the same day, one in the Los Angeles Times and the other in the Financial Times of London. That day, appropriately enough, was the Ides of March, March 15th of 1999. And these two stories go a long way toward corroborating something that I've been maintaining, namely that in the wake of the Cold War, the next major struggle is going to be between, or actually is now shaping up, between Germany and the United States. The struggles described here are struggles between the EU and the United States, one in the matter of trade and one perhaps at some point in the future over military matters. But as I've noted in numerous broadcasts, including a broadcast called The Coming of the European Union and also a program called German Domination of the European Economy and also a program called Tides of 20th Century Capital Flow, over a period of years and over an historical period embracing among other things, the Franco-Prussian War, the First World War, and in particular the Second World War, Germany has, for the most part, subjugated the economies of all of the other countries of Europe using a variety of different tactics. And essentially, Germany has, from an economic and political standpoint, colonized most of the rest of Europe. And the EU basically is a German creature and essentially a vehicle for German hegemony and imperialism. So when one sees Europe and the EU here, one can read between the lines, Germany. And again, the next major conflict on the Europe on the world stage is going to be between Germany and the United States. That's already shaping up. My personal opinion is that Germany will emerge triumphant. The LA Times of Monday, March 15th of 1999, carries an article which quotes a number of different U.S. and European observers whose pronouncements to a large extent echo precisely what I've been saying on this program. This is an article by John Thor Dahlberg, D-A-H-L-B-U-R-G, an L.A. Times staff writer. It's Dateline London, headlined, U.S. and Europe Edging to Brink of a Trade War. The article reads, is subheaded, I should say, Commerce, Banana Conflict Could Be Dwarfed by Battles Over Genetically Altered Food and Aircraft Noise. And skipping down, of the coming trade war, or the projected trade war, actually in many ways already begun between the European Union and the United States, we read, quote, Some people believe this is the new conflict after the Soviets have gone, unquote, observed U.S. Agriculture Secretary Dan Glickman. Under that thesis, increasing globalization of markets and of competition, combined with the absence of a common and unifying threat like the communist bloc, makes clashes over business interests more, and not less, likely. And skipping down, quote, It's a straight rattling of swords back and forth, unquote, Representative Porter J. Goss, a Florida Republican involved in the airplane dispute, has said. And skipping down yet again, quote, One mustn't underestimate the seriousness of the dangers the transatlantic relationship is going through at the moment, unquote, said Guillaume McLaughlin, analyst at the European Policy Center, a Brussels think tank. Again quoting, The bottom line is that the banana issue is just a precursor to much more vitally important issues, unquote. And then skipping down again, Roderick Abbott, head of the European Union's trade delegation in Geneva, has accused the United States of, quote, declaring war, unquote, on commercial competitors. This time, some experts believe, Europe's resolve to fight back is stiffened by the existence of the euro, a common currency adopted by 11 of the 15 EU member countries in January. Quote, the arrival of a single unified money means Europe can punch harder on the world stage and make its mark in terms of trade, economics, and politics, unquote, an official of the EU's executive contended. And again, I have contended in a couple of different broadcasts, actually numerous broadcasts, including one called The Coming of the European Monetary Union in early 1998, and another at the very beginning of 1999 called The Euro, the Dollar, and Currency Speculation, that the European Monetary Union is the realization of a plan for German world domination formulated in the 1840s by pan-German theoretician Friedrich Liszt. The actual subjects which have triggered the trade war, namely the dispute over bananas imported into the European Union, and also a number of different disputes about genetically modified foods, should not mask one to the long-term strategic significance and political significance of this coming conflict. The banana wars, I guess one could say, is due on the American side to a classic case of political cronyism in which Carl Lindner of Chiquita, I believe it is, who is a major contributor to the Republican and Democratic parties, has exerted influence through Washington lobbyists to on behalf of the Chiquita firm. And the European side involves basically neo-colonialism, in which some of Europe's former colonial territories have been exporting bananas to Europe at a very cheap rate. And that marks a classic turf battle and, in essence, a continuation of the colonial struggles that marked much of the 19th and early part of the 20th century. Obviously, genetically modified foods constitute a new wrinkle in trade affairs. And the United States has taken a consummately stupid attitude, in my opinion, toward genetically modified foods, marketing them virtually without regulation, something that's likely to come back to haunt us. However, the relatively ephemeral nature of the individual trade disputes, also one over airplane noise, should not mask one to the consummate overall strategic significance of these coming conflicts. This is the next major world struggle, one between Germany and the United States, and unless the United States wakes up to the nature of this struggle, it is my personal opinion that the Germans are going to win, and beneath the mask of the, quote, new, unquote, Germany, note the quotes, is what I call the Underground Reich and chiefly the deadly Bormann organization, about which I have spoken so many times. And if this conflict is in fact resolved in favor of Germany, and I believe that will be the outcome, barring a drastic change, that will mark the triumph of the Underground Reich and the triumph of the forces embodied in Adolf Hitler. The very same day that that article appeared on the front page of the Los Angeles Times, namely, again, Monday, March 15th of 1999, the Ides of March of 1999, the Financial Times of London carried a very, very important story, one that I believe corresponds in the military field to the trade struggle that is described in that article from the L.A. Times of 3/15/99. This is an article by Peter Norman in Eltville, Germany. It's headlined, EU may need own military staff to act without NATO, says Bonn. The European Union may need its own military staff and policy institutions if it is to take decisions on military action without NATO resources, according to a German discussion paper. Joschka Fischer, Germany's foreign minister, presented the suggestions to EU foreign ministers at an informal weekend meeting. The paper is aimed at stimulating discussion ahead of the June summit in Cologne, where a strengthened defense and security policy is on the agenda. The German ideas for a, quote, common European policy on security and defense, unquote, would enable the Union to take and implement quick military decisions in crisis areas such as Kosovo without recourse to the assets and capabilities of the U.S.-dominated NATO alliance. Mr. Fischer's paper, prepared by Bonn as part of Germany's role as the EU's current president, concludes with a series of questions rather than proposals. And skipping down, the weekend discussion reflected a widespread desire among EU countries to escape what one diplomat called, quote, U.S. unilateralism, unquote, and domination on defense issues. But it raised difficult points for many member states. Note this German proposal for military autonomy by the EU, and in particular, the need by the EU to address issues such as Kosovo. The very first act of the reunified Germany was to precipitate the Balkans War. The EU voted at the time 11-1 to maintain the integrity of the Yugoslav Federation. Germany scotched that. That precipitated the Balkans War when Germany forced the EU to recognize the secession of Slovenia and Croatia, the latter a reconstruction of the Croatian fascist puppet state from the Second World War. And as we took a look at in a pair of half-hour segments that were recorded in December of 1998 called Update on Germany, the intelligence services of Germany, both the BND and German military intelligence, have actively supported the Kosovo Liberation Army. In addition to precipitating the first major land war in Europe since the Second World War, no sooner had Germany reunified than they effected through the Hans Seidel Stiftung, as documented in Martin Lee's landmark book, The Beast Reawakens. Using the Hans Seidel Stiftung, Germany precipitated the breakup of Czechoslovakia and the virtual colonization of the Czech Republic. I would also note that in 1993, the UN Security Council was actively debating sending peacekeeping forces to Germany in order to maintain the physical security of minorities, in particular non-white minorities, in the, quote, new, unquote, Germany, whose Inspector General of its armed forces, Klaus Naumann, in an address to his officers in the early 1990s, said that now that Germany was reunified and now that the Cold War was over, it was the task of the German army to roll back the values of liberty, equality, and fraternity, the values of the French Revolution. A stunning comment for the head of the German armed forces, the equivalent of our chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, to make. By the way, Naumann is now head of the Permanent Military Committee of NATO. Jumping across the Atlantic, one subject I've been discussing on and off for a number of years is gun control, and I am opposed to gun control, and I don't think the arguments that have been mustered against gun control are particularly intelligent. There was a very intelligent argument against gun control and piercing many of the key myths cited by gun control advocates. This was carried in an op-ed column that was carried in the Wall Street Journal on Wednesday, November 11th of 1998. A tip of the hat goes to a listener who researched this for us and sent it in to me. This is an op-ed column by John R. Lott Jr. That's L-O-T-T. Mr. Lott is a fellow at the University of Chicago Law School and the author of More Guns, Less Crime, Understanding Crime and Gun Control Laws, published by the University of Chicago Press, copyright 1998. By the way, some of the discussion concerning my opposition to gun control can be found in two miscellaneous archive shows, one entitled Purdy's Last Stand, an analysis of the Stockton Schoolyard Massacre from January of 1989, and also The Seeds of Nuremberg from the fall, or the spring, rather, of 1994. There's also a lecture available from Spitfire entitled Fascism, Gun Control, and the Intelligence Community. Turning to this op-ed column from the Wall Street Journal of 11-11-98, University of Chicago Law School fellow John R. Lott writes this particular column again. Gun control advocates purvey deadly myths, and skipping down we read, myths about guns can threaten people's safety by frightening them and preventing them from using the most effective means to defend themselves. Here are five of the most prevalent myths. 1. When one is attacked, passive behavior is the safest approach. The Department of Justice's National Crime Victimization Survey reports that the probability of serious injury from an attack is 2.5 times greater for women offering no resistance than for women resisting with a gun. Men also benefit from using a gun, but the benefits are smaller. Offering no resistance is 1.4 times more likely to result in serious injury than resisting with a gun. Resistance with a gun is the safest course of action for victims to take. The second myth, friends or relatives are the most likely killers. This myth is usually based on two claims, that 53% of murder victims are killed by either relatives or acquaintances, and that anyone could be a murderer. With the broad definition of acquaintances, unquote, used in the FBI's uniform crime reports, most victims are indeed classified as knowing their killer. But what's not made clear is that acquaintance murder primarily includes drug buyers killing pushers, cab drivers killed by first-time customers, gang members killing other gang members, prostitutes killed by their clients, and so on. Only one U.S. city, Chicago, reports a precise breakdown on the nature of acquaintance killings, and the statistic gives a very different impression. Between 1990 and 1995, just 17% of murder victims were either family members, friends, neighbors, or roommates of their killers. Murderers are also not average citizens. About 90% of adult murderers already have an adult criminal record. Murderers are overwhelmingly young males with low IQs who have long histories of difficulty getting along with others. The next myth? The U.S. has a high murder rate because Americans own so many guns. There is no international evidence backing this up. The Swiss, New Zealanders, and Finns all own guns as frequently as Americans, yet in 1995, Switzerland had a murder rate 40% lower than Germany's, and New Zealand had one lower than Australia's. Finland and Sweden have very different gun ownership rates, but very similar murder rates. Israel, with a higher gun ownership rate than the U.S., has a murder rate 40% below Canada's. When one studies all countries rather than just a select few, there is no relationship between gun ownership and murder. U.S. data indicates that those states that have had the largest increases in gun ownership have had the greatest drop in violent crime rates. The next myth? If law-abiding citizens are allowed to carry concealed handguns, people will end up shooting each other after traffic accidents, as well as accidentally shooting police officers. Millions of people currently hold concealed handgun permits, and some states have issued them for as long as 60 years. Yet only one permit holder has ever used a concealed handgun after a traffic accident, and that case was ruled as self-defense. The type of person willing to go through the permitting process is extremely law-abiding. In Florida, almost 444,000 licenses were granted from 1987 to 1997, but only 84 people have lost their licenses for any violations involving firearms. Most violations that lead to permits being revoked involve accidentally carrying a gun into restricted areas like airports or schools. In Virginia, not a single permit holder has committed a violent crime. Similar encouraging results have been reported in Kentucky, Nevada, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Texas, the only other states where information is available. The next myth? The family gun is more likely to kill you or someone you know than to kill in self-defense. The 1993 study yielding such numbers, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, never actually inquired as to whose gun was used in the killing. Instead, if a household owned a gun, and if a person in that household or someone he knew was shot to death while in the home, the gun in the household was blamed. In fact, virtually all the killings in the study were committed with guns brought in by an intruder. No more than 4% of the gun deaths in the study can be attributed to the homeowner's gun. Also ignored is that 98% of the time when people use a gun defensively, merely brandishing the weapon is sufficient to stop an attack. In less than 1% of the cases, is a gun even fired directly at the attacker. And I think that column speaks for itself. And once again, a tip of the hat to a listener who researched that for us from the Wall Street Journal of 11/11/98. Another subject that I've covered in connection with Ed Haslam's landmark work, Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, is the contamination of the polio vaccine with an apparently cancer-causing virus, the SV40 or simian virus 40. This is that topic is discussed in numerous broadcasts, many broadcasts done with or in conjunction with the work of Ed Haslam, again, author of Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, subtitled The Story of an Underground Medical Laboratory. It's also discussed in a recent update on health and scientific matters. In a nutshell, the thrust of Ed's thesis is that not only was the polio vaccine contaminated with the SV40, but that contamination has led to a soft tissue cancer epidemic, which is being covered up, and that research into mutating the virus to create a vaccine may very well have resulted in the development of AIDS, and the milieu involved with the research into mutating the SV40 to find a benign strain to make a vaccine with was carried out by people that were involved, were overlapped the milieu of the assassination of President Kennedy. A listener sent in an article involving some disclosures by Dr. Ben Sweet, S-W-E-E-T, who had done some of the pioneering research on the contamination of the polio vaccine. This is an article entitled The Polio Vaccine and Simian Virus 40, subtitled After 30 Years, Prominent Polio Vaccine Researcher Confirms Suspicions About Monkey Virus Contamination. It's authored by T.J. Moriarty, M-O-R-I-A-R-T-Y. This apparently came from the OL or online news at AOL.com. And this also can be found at a website, www.chronicillnet, one word, chronicillnet.org. And again, a tip of the hat to a listener. Of Dr. Sweet's disclosures, we read, skipping down, quote, "First, we knew that SV40 had oncogenic properties, cancer-causing, in hamsters, which was bad news. Secondly, we found out that it hybridized with certain DNA viruses like adeno or adenovirus, A-D-E-N-O, such that the adenovirus would then have SV40 genes attached to it. We couldn't clean up the adenovirus vaccine seed stocks grown in monkey kidney cells only," unquote. The seed stocks apparently were always contaminated, but the vaccines were still administered. Possibly the most unsettling part of his research that he carries with him 30 years later is knowing that an untold number of people, possibly in the tens of millions, were exposed with this virus, whether they were given the live or killed polio vaccine. Quote, "Even the people who received a killed polio virus vaccine could have been infected. Those papers we wrote were incorrect at the time, stating that formalin-killed vaccines were free of simian SV40 virus. But the new information regarding the killed ones was never published," unquote, he added. "By then, it was too late. These findings came after the mass inoculations with the polio vaccine. The distinction between live and killed vaccines is a critical one. The scientific community and the American public was told that killed vaccines were undoubtedly safe because formalin was used to destroy any contaminating simian virus. The 39 or so simian viruses prior to SV40 were probably inactivated with formalin, but not SV40. The virus eluded the virus-killing behavior of formalin. This now meant even the killed vaccines unintentionally contained small amounts of active virus," unquote. So even after 1963, the, quote, killed, unquote, vaccine appears to have been contaminated with SV40. And another piece of information, new at least to me, from this article was that the SV40 bonds with DNA viruses such as the adeno or adenovirus. As we've looked at in past broadcasts, the SV40 is also transmitted sexually. By having unprotected sex with someone who carries a virus, you can get it. It also apparently can be passed from mothers to children. Speaking of cancer vaccines, which apparently was a vain attempt that came out of the SV40 research, apparently Cuba has been proceeding with work on cancer vaccines, and a Canadian pharmaceutical company, has been developing and testing these vaccines, which, according to that company, look quite promising. This certainly could create a political football. We haven't got a lot of time, but this is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, March 18th of 1999. It's an article by Barry Brown entitled "Cuban Medicine Leaps into the Future" at Stateline Toronto. It concerns the research by Toronto-based York Medical Incorporated into the Cuban anti-cancer drugs. And skipping down, we read, "The drugs, which have been shown to be safe and effective in human trials in Cuba, are seen as a potential boon in the treatment of the most severe solid tumors, head and neck, brain, lung, breast, and ovarian cancers." Dr. Mark Vincent, a medical professor at the University of Western Ontario, said his initial work on the Cuban cancer therapy has left him, quote, "impressed with the innovative quality of some of the approaches to treat and prevent cancer," unquote. But skipping down, "Sources at the U.S. State and Treasury Department say these therapies, even if they turn out to be miracle drugs, could not be legally sold in the United States without a special license, a development that is currently not on the horizon." That concludes this segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.